This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Hockey Hall of Fame, like other sports halls of fame, is a glittering celebration of heroes and heroic acts within the game the hall commemorates. Nobody's hockey achievements glitter more brightly than those of Wayne Gretzky, who retired in 1999 with a record 894 goals. He broke the previous record, held by Gordie Howe and long considered unbreakable, back in 1994 with goal number 802. That's what goal number 802 sounded like. After the goal, the game was temporarily suspended so the occasion could be celebrated by NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman.
We wish you nothing but a long, continuous career and that you should play long enough to score another 802 goals.
One display in that glittering hockey hall includes 802 pucks, which is about right, exactly right, in fact, in terms of the number with which Gretzky passed Howe. You need to know about that display because therein lies a tale of a visit to the hall told by Wayne Gretzky. He was speaking at a press conference in 2016.
A couple years ago, I took my son, time was 11 or 12, and I had a hat on and just told him, keep your head down. We walked around for 2 hours.
Toward the end of that walk, Gretzky the younger and his record-breaking dad came upon an interactive display where visitors could shoot pucks at a cyber goalie. Few visitors can resist the challenge, or at least young Gretzky couldn't.
We went down to the part where you could actually interact and take some shots. So my son got out there and he was 4 for 5. And so he said, Dad, try it. So I said, okay, and I got out there and I missed the first 3 shots I took.
Which seems impossible, but okay, maybe the great one was a little rusty.
And the young man who was taking care of the line walked over to me and said, sir, if you move your hand down the stick a little bit farther. And I lifted my hat up and I said, can you go get me one of those pucks that are in there? There's 802 up there. My son killed himself laughing and I got out of there.
It's a better story than it would have been if Wayne Gretzky had stepped up to that display and calmly beaten his son's best effort by going 5 for 5, isn't it? A more unlikely story, certainly, but a better one, right? Sure it is. More stories set in hockey to come on Only a Game's take on Hockey Night, or Hockey Morning, or Hockey whenever you're listening to the program. But now it's time for 3 stories you should know, and I'm joined by Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson and by the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Welcome back to both of you.
Bill!
Thanks for having me.
Joan, you're up first this week.
I am going to talk about mental health in sports, which until this week, when I heard those words, I always thought straight to CTE in football. I mean, the NFL's head injury crisis has dominated headlines, but it's not always super relatable, especially to someone like me who my football career ended when I broke my arm in flag football in 5th grade. That changed recently, first when DeMar DeRozan and then Kevin Love, 2 NBA players, spoke publicly about their struggles with mental health. These are players who don't wear helmets, who don't ram their heads into other men for a living, and they're dealing with issues that sound familiar probably to millions of people: panic attacks, depression, anxiety, loneliness. I covered Kevin Love when he played for the Minnesota Timberwolves, and I have to say, Kevin was about as relatable as any pro athlete could be, in my opinion, but he was always very private. Seeing him be so honest, though, this week in his story in the Players Tribune about his panic attack he suffered last November, it was really encouraging to read that and to see that he was able to kind of open up and, it seems like, let a lot of things out that had been stewing. But it couldn't help but be a little bit sad when I thought of all the stress he'd been holding in and all the stress that probably dozens, hundreds of other athletes are holding in the same position. And in Love's story, he mentions that the Cavaliers helped set him up with a therapist after he suffered that panic attack. More and more teams are hiring sports psychologists, other professionals, to give their players a mental edge on the court. But I wonder if we shouldn't be separating the sports and the psychology into 2 separate things. Love said in the story that when he's talking with his therapist, he rarely talks about basketball at all. And I think that's important. And I wonder if, with all the resources athletes are provided, I think a proactive approach to therapy and mental health seems like a logical next step.
I would go so far as to say that, you know, Kevin Love is a NBA title holder, but this might end up being one of the great legacies of his athletic career, is destigmatizing mental health, and DeMar DeRozan as well, and other athletes who have come forward on this. I mean, this is not revolutionary stuff, the idea of talk therapy being beneficial to persons, but especially in an environment like professional athletics, it is still something that feels a little bit unapproachable and distant. And so just the idea that people are talking about it, especially young people, especially people who look up to athletes and are influenced by them, is a tremendous thing.
My only worry with Kevin Love's piece in the Players' Tribune is that people who are unfamiliar with depression and panic attacks may read it and say, oh, all I have to do is acknowledge with a therapist that I'm sad about my grandmother's death and I'm all set. And Kevin Love says he sees the therapist when the team is at home, when he can work it into his schedule. For a lot of folks dealing with these kinds of issues, a more significant commitment of time and energy is probably necessary. And that's really the only small problem I have with the Love piece in the Players' Tribune.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think another thing it doesn't touch on is the fact that these can be very expensive services depending on your health care.
Yeah.
And obviously, Kevin Love has every resource at his fingertips, and that's great that he's using them. But for a lot of people, it's a financial commitment as well.
I would agree with all that, but I would also say just the idea of getting anybody in the door in a therapy situation is incredibly beneficial. And oftentimes, you know, the therapist will be able to create a strategy for people, whether it's both an economic one or a time one or even a pharmacological one. There's no sort of one-size-fits-all approach here, and I would commend anybody for taking that step.
We're going to stay in the NBA for my topic. In his 15th NBA season, LeBron James said on Wednesday night that he felt his play was, and I'm quoting, at an all-time high, and he might be right. He scored 39 points in a game against the Nuggets that night. And he's got some believers, a Philadelphia business-sponsored billboards in Cleveland urging LeBron to leave Cleveland and join the 76ers. In L.A., there are billboards urging James to become a Laker. I read an article this week that said that in order to persuade James to stay in Cleveland, the owner of the Cavaliers might offer him a piece of the team. I don't even know if that's legal, but it certainly speaks to his desire to have James stay around. Anyway, my question is so much focus on one player in a team game a good idea for the NBA, for any franchises yearning to sign him, and for fans who value basketball at its best anyway, because it's five players at a time working together rather than one guy in the spotlight? Jason, what do you think?
Oh, I think LeBron James is unbelievably worth it. He's been to seven straight finals, and in each instance, were you to remove him from the team, that team would have not made the final. So his value is unquestionable. I'm very happy, Bill, also that the professional athlete free agency is keeping the billboard industry alive. You know, isn't it so strange in a digital environment that there is still great belief that driving by something on the highway is the most persuasive medium? You know, basketball has proven itself, maybe for the worse, over the last decade or so, to be a very individual choice-driven league. And what I mean by that is that the movement, the migration of just a handful of players can turn the balance completely around. And so LeBron James, wherever he ends up, is going to be absolutely a game changer for that franchise. So he's special that way.
This is LeBron. This isn't even another guy in the top echelon. This is the top of the mountain when it comes to basketball. And he's also proven to be, you know, such a great guy on all levels. You know, any team would be lucky to have him on the court and off the court, it seems like, for what he does for the city and just the team and for younger players. I'm inclined to agree with Jason there.
Well, you guys seem to be making the argument that he should just switch teams every year and bring what he brings to a city to every city, and then everybody would be happy at least for a year. Maybe that's the way to handle it.
Maybe he plays like five games for each team, and then whatever team ends up, you know, at the top of the standings. But again, I want to go back to the fact that the key word here is billboards. I mean, we're going to be sitting here in the spring or in the early summer, and LeBron James is going to be saying something like, listen, I was about to sign with Team X, but I was on Interstate 95 and I saw that billboard crying out to me, and wow, it just changed my mind.
Well, I understand that you're saying now the key word is billboard. I was led to believe that this week you thought the key word was bullpen cart.
Yes, a brilliant segue, Littlefield. We are returning to retro technologies to seduce both the athlete and the fan. I'm talking about bullpen carts. Bullpen carts We're a phenomenon, which some of us will remember. We're introduced in the 50s, but sort of peaked in the 60s and late 70s. They were in ballparks, and their purpose was to shuttle relievers into the pitching mound. And they were these goofy contraptions that kind of looked like a AMC Gremlin matched with something in a children's book. And they had little hats on them. They're basically modified golf carts. And they went away. We haven't seen them in a generation until now. The Arizona Diamondbacks announced this week that they will bring back two, not one, but two golf carts. They will be the first in the franchise's 21-year-old history. It will not be compulsory. I know you guys are worried about that and whether or not the relievers are going to have to take the bullpen carts. The Diamondbacks are respectful of the fact that some pitchers might not want to seem lazy being chauffeured to the mound. I applaud this phenomenon. I like it. Now all I want is $5 box seats, and then we're good.
Oh, good luck with that. Joan, what do you think? You happy to see the return of the bullpen cart, at least in Arizona?
You know, I love anything retro when it comes to baseball. I also really love vehicles driving on baseball diamonds. One of my first memories of going to a baseball game was when Ozzie Smith retired and they gave him a car, or they drove him around in a car or something. And I was very impressed as a child. So I really like this in that sense. I also just love baseball. I love ridiculous things pertaining to baseball. So this is really in my lane.
Well, I'm going to have to disagree with you guys again, because just what baseball and the ballpark needs, somewhere else to slap a corporate logo.
Oh!
And here's another observation from the skeptical side. Are these going to be environmentally friendly, these bullpen carts? Are they going to run on wind power or perhaps solar power stored in a battery? I don't know. I wait to see. Arizona's got lots of sun. We'd like to see that, right? Beyond that, I'd simply say to the relief pitchers, don't forget to wave from the passenger seat. And I guess it's okay.
Bill, I thought you were going to say you objected because you were worried about a new wave of relief pitcher obesity and that this was going to lead to that. I do think that they are electric. I don't know how environmentally correct electric they are. I think it would be a great idea if they come up with an avocado oil-powered bullpen cart, and I would encourage this.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson and The Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before the 2016 NHL All-Star Game, a popular hockey podcast began telling its listeners to vote for an enforcer named John Scott.
And I remember sort of feeling a little bit bad about it because John Scott's a human being. So to make him into a joke, you know, it seemed a little bit like schoolyard bullying.
But the story doesn't end there. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Wolf of Walnut Street left the following review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. I have been listening to Only a Game weekly for years, and it is one of my favorite podcasts. Not only do you get updates on the most recent sports events, but you get great reporting from host Bill Littlefield and friends. This is a great podcast, not only for sports enthusiasts, but also for anyone who is interested in seeing how sports are a mirror into our society. Thanks, Wolf of Walnut Street. If you'd like to help members of your pack, see what I did there, find Only a Game, please consider leaving a review of your own on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help other listeners find our show.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a show where people gather to speak freely. You might learn something new, hear things that challenge you, and on Friday, we review the week's top stories. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. When it comes to pro athletes, the stereotype does not always reflect reality. There's perhaps no greater example than former professional hockey player John Scott. Anders Kelto begins the story back in 2016.
When I first met up with John Scott, He was living in St. John's, Newfoundland, in the easternmost part of Canada. But his wife and kids were at their home back in Michigan. So John had set up a video camera in the living room so that he could check in on his family.
So now they don't even know we're watching. They think I'm gone.
I wonder if they're going to develop a paranoia complex.
He's always watching. Yeah, I hope not.
John is possibly the most lovable dad ever.
Oh, you want to say goodbye to Dada.
Bye, Dada. Bye, Dada.
Bye.
Miss you, love you. Yeah.
Miss you, love you. You guys have a good day, okay? I'll talk
to you. A dad who built a career out of punching people in the face.
That's Scott. Oh, with a jersey over his head, he landed an uppercut. And another, and another.
Scott is 260 pounds. He's 6'8".
As I got to know John a little better, I have to admit, I was a little confused. I mean, how does someone who is so nice and so gentle beat people up for a living?
Did you actually enjoy fighting?
No, gosh, no. I don't think anybody would enjoy getting punched in the face. I think, you know, like, why would you ever want to, well, what are you going to do tomorrow? I'm going to fight somebody. It's like, it sounds terrible.
So how did John end up with this terrible job? And really, how did fighting become part of hockey in the first place? It turns out, it's been around for quite some time.
Yeah, it's been a part of the game since the beginning. You know, hockey's roots back in the late 1800s were that it's a self-policing game.
This is John Branch, a reporter from the New York Times.
And so, you know, without referees on the ice, if things got a little chippy, the guys on the ice dealt with their own problems.
That's how it worked for decades. Fighting was a way to police the game. Until the 1970s, when this team came along called the Philadelphia Flyers. They were nicknamed the Broad Street Bullies.
They were a team that showed that fighting and intimidation and rough play could lead to championships.
Suddenly, other teams were like, oh, that's how you win. You play rough. So teams started signing tougher players. And hockey entered this really violent era.
It's a big, ugly brawl.
And just when hockey was at its most violent, a player came along who was anything but.
Sorry, to Gretzky! Scores! He did it!
Wayne Gretzky.
The greatest goal scorer!
Gretzky started shattering records.
50 goals in 39 games!
But he was young and really skinny. 6 feet tall, 160 pounds. So there was an obvious way to stop him.
Dave Taylor knocked Wayne Gretzky flat. Gretzky is on the ice.
Now, if you're Gretzky's team, the Edmonton Oilers, you can't have Gretzky getting hurt with all this rough play.
And you hire a guy like Marty McSorley to say, look, if anything happens to Wayne, take care of that other team. Protect this guy.
Rodgers and McSorley throwing some rights, and he decks Rodgers. McSorley just knocked Rodgers flat on his back.
Pretty soon, the idea caught on. Teams were like, you've got a big guy? Well, guess what? We've got a bigger, tougher guy.
And so these guys were taking boxing lessons. They were taking taekwondo lessons to learn how to wrestle. They spent more time working on their fighting ability than they did their hockey ability.
John Scott says he was never the best player on his team as a kid. But there was one thing that set him apart. He was enormous.
My coaches in college, they like sat me down. They said, hey, listen, like you're good. And you have one thing that no one has, and that's your size. Like you can't teach size.
By the end of his college career at Michigan Tech University, John had never been in a fight. But the very next year, when he joined a semi-pro team in Houston,
other teams would come in and they would see me and they'd see my size and they'd challenge me, you know? It's just natural. When you're the big guy, you always have to fight. Like, people just want to prove themselves against you. So I've been asked tons of times, let's fight. I'm like, why? Like, well, why do you want to fight me? Did I do something or did you do something? Like, why? And I'd always say no.
His teammates started to think, this gentle giant is going to snap one of these days and actually fight someone. They just hoped it wasn't against the wrong guy. And then the wrong guy rolled into town.
St. Louis, roundhouse right hand by DJ King. Now some quick left-hand jabs by DJ King.
DJ King was a legend in the minor leagues back in 2006. He had beaten up a lot of people, like badly. So true to form, when he got on the ice, he came after John Scott.
He was a big guy, and that's why I went after him, and that was the way it started.
And when he's challenging you, he's like shaking his gloves, and it's like, you don't want to back down because then you'll be like bullied forever. And so it was one of those times where it's just like, okay, I got to do this. Like, I'm not going to back down from this guy. And so we just dropped the gloves and took the helmets off and fought.
I just kind of played a defensive fight after a while, right? Because you got to change your fight when the guy is a lot bigger than you.
So, like, once that was over, like, what was your feeling at the end of the fight?
It was relief, and, like, I was happy. I was like, okay, I was happy I didn't get beat up, and I know my team was proud of me because they were like, wow, like, you did well against this guy. And it was a huge, yeah, moment for me.
It was a huge moment because it gave John all this confidence, and it opened up a whole new world. Now, he could fight the toughest guys out there, and there was a market for that. A little while later, John got a phone call, a call he could have only dreamed of as a kid. He was joining the Minnesota Wild of the National Hockey League.
Yeah, my first shift, you look up and it's like Datsuk and Lidstrom. It's like guys you grew up idolizing. It's just, it is nerve-wracking, but it's also just like, this is cool. Like, you're there. Like, this is the pinnacle. This is the best it'll ever be.
For his first 2 years in the league, John was living the dream, making almost $500,000 a year and playing well. Statistics show that his team was better when he was on the ice. But after 2 years with Minnesota, he was a free agent, and he got signed by a new team, the Chicago Blackhawks.
And that's where the switch started.
The switch to being more of like an enforcer.
More of a fighter, more of a, yeah, just a forward who only played like 7 minutes a game, didn't play as much as a D-man, and it was just a big change.
And how'd you feel about that?
I didn't like it. Obviously, I wanted to be a player first, but again, you just do what you have to do to survive, and if that's what I had to do, I did it.
But a big edge to John Scott in this fight. Oh, and he got in another right hand.
John Scott, the best heavyweight in the entire NHL.
I mean, he's a monster.
Cam Jansen is a former enforcer who fought John three times.
He was hard to fight because he was so big. You know, he threw pretty hard, and he was pretty willing to go. So yeah, he was definitely fearful.
John was winning all of his fights, but mentally, he was not doing well. Here's his wife, Danielle.
Like, when he first started playing hockey in the NHL, like, he was just full of energy, and he was just like, so excited, and then it wasn't like that anymore.
Like, I would just not sleep. It was very stressful because I would just want to do well. And that's the thing, I wasn't even like a fighter. I just was worried about it.
Where, like, I'd look over at night and he'd be like looking up hockey fights.
On the computer?
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's like, now that I know John better, he'd say, oh, we're going to play this team next week and they've got a tough guy, and he'd say that in passing. I'd be like, oh, okay. And then he'd say it like one more time and I'd be like, okay. And now to me that's like, okay, I'm nervous. That's him saying I'm nervous.
Once was bad enough, twice was shocking, and now for the third time since May, an NHL player has died.
In the summer of 2011, after John's first full season with the Chicago Blackhawks, this terrible thing happened. Three NHL enforcers died. Two were later found to have CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, basically brain damage from repeated blows to the head. The deaths caused some people to call for an end to fighting. As always, the NHL stood its ground and said it would not ban fights. But at the same time, more and more teams were analyzing game data, and they saw something interesting. Enforcers didn't actually have the positive effect that they thought. They weren't preventing injuries to star players, and they weren't helping their teams win. So true enforcers, guys whose primary job was to fight, started disappearing from the league. When John Scott first joined the NHL in 2008, there were still quite a few enforcers around. But by 2016, there were almost none. During that time, John bounced around the league, playing for six different teams and ending up in Arizona. And even though he hadn't set out to be an enforcer, he was one of the last members of this vanishing breed.
It's going to sound harsh to say this, but he became a punchline.
This is Amelie Benjamin, a writer for NHL.com.
Because of what happened with fighting in the league and the way it was being phased out, he was just this sort of anachronistic figure.
So just when John had become a sort of pariah of the NHL, things took a really bizarre turn. Some guys who run a popular hockey podcast got an idea.
Oh my God, John Scott All-Star. Oh,
yeah. John Scott All-Star. So during the 2015-16 season, fans got to vote players into the NHL All-Star game. So these podcasters started a movement, Vote John Scott.
I think it really started as a joke. It was this game of if you're going to allow us fans to vote people into the All-Star game, why should we take this seriously?
John Scott is the one. I want John Scott at the All-Star game.
Oh, God, it'd be perfect.
Yes, send that man to Nashville.
The guy who came up with the idea is ESPN reporter Greg Wyshynski. At the time, he was with Yahoo Sports.
So we put the idea out there through the podcast, and then the good folks on Reddit decided to really kind of get in back of it.
And I remember sort of feeling a little bit bad about it because John Scott's a human being. So to make him into a joke, you know, it seemed a little bit like schoolyard bullying.
John Scott is cherry picking. Oh, wait, no, he just lost his breath at his own blue line.
The first few weeks, I just didn't embrace it at all. I just kind of wanted it to go away because it was just, you're being made fun of.
So John released a statement saying, thanks, guys, I appreciate it, but don't vote for me, vote for my teammates, the guys who actually deserve it. Of course, that didn't work.
There's a surprise leader in fan voting for the upcoming NHL All-Star Game, and his name is, yeah, John Scott, seriously.
The NHL viewed this as an embarrassment. They literally took the banner that you could click on to go to the All-Star Game voting from the top of NHL.com and buried it at the bottom so people wouldn't know where to vote. And so I'm thinking to myself, well, if the NHL is trying to bury the vote, they're going to find a way to undo it at the end.
A couple days later, John was lifting weights with his teammates, and the general manager of his team, the Arizona Coyotes, tapped him on the shoulder.
He calls me in to the stick room, and he's like, yeah, we just traded you to Montreal. And I was like, what? Like, are you kidding me?
Then things got even stranger for John.
The Canadians, get this, are sending the NHL All-Star down to the minors. A decision on whether Scott will actually get to play in the NHL All-Star game will be decided next week.
Now, in my mind, the All-Star game's done. Like, there's no way I'm going. They're not going to let me go.
John now had 24 hours to pack his bags and report to St. John's, Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. That's about as far away as you can get from Arizona when he was there and still be on the continent.
And to make things worse, his wife Danielle was 8 months pregnant with twins. And they already had two young daughters, ages 2 and 4.
I was like, all right, well, I just started looking at flights and the travel time was like 14 and a half hours, 17 hours, like just crazy travel times and then so expensive. And then my heart sank. I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to see you.
I was extra upset and emotional and just kind of, and I just went home. I was like, holy cow. And next thing I know, I'm on a flight like 5 a.m. the next morning to go to St. John's, Newfoundland.
Hi,
Gabriella.
So John arrives in eastern Canada.
You want to go see Dada, Gabriella?
Yeah.
You know where I'm going to see you?
Hockey team.
Pretty soon, everyone is convinced that this trade was orchestrated by the NHL to prevent John from playing in the All-Star game. And then John does something that really gets the fans behind him. He reveals that the league had pressured him not to play. Someone from the NHL had called him up and asked him, what would your kids think of you playing as a joke candidate?
But once the NHL gets on the phone with you and tries to leverage your children against you and try to guilt you that way, nah, man. I go.
It went from this, your joke, the NHL's a joke, to, wait, now we're going to stand behind John Scott because this was unfair in the way he was treated.
The public pressure seems to work because soon John hears that he will be allowed to play in the game after all. 2 weeks later, he arrives in Nashville. So here John is on national television in the NHL All-Star Game, surrounded by the best players in the world.
No, I was losing it. Yeah, I was shaking the whole time I was doing it because I was so overwhelmed, and the fans, they did not help by like cheering and like all that stuff. So it was just nerve-wracking. Yeah.
I was in pain. Like, getting up was real hard. Walking around was real hard. And I could tell they were close.
I'm worried about her giving birth, like, because she was due any day.
Like, you might look up in the stands.
And she's gone. She's at the hospital. Like, it was legit. I had to give someone my phone during the game. If someone calls, tell me, and well, I'm going to leave the game.
All eyes are on John Scott. And every fan is basically wondering the same things.
What would happen? What would he do? Would his wife give birth in the middle of the All-Star game? There are all sorts of storylines.
On his first shift, John gets the puck. He skates it into the corner, passes it to his teammate, Brent Burns. Burns gives it back to Scott. And then...
Scott scores! Johnny Scott!
John scores. On his very first shot.
There you go.
He's only been on the ice for a few seconds.
He's going to get a standing ovation.
It was like the perfect icebreaker. I was just like, oh, thank gosh, I got that out of the way. And then I could relax and like, okay, I scored one. I didn't embarrass myself and I can just go and play now. And it was perfect.
You know, the first goal was sort of a gimme.
Again, hockey reporter Greg Wyshynski.
You figured he'd get one during the game. They'd set him up somehow. But then comes a play of real hockey skill.
Bernsey had the puck and I saw he had control of it behind the net. He made a nice pass to me up the middle and I had a breakaway.
At this point, I remember watching him go down the ice on the breakaway and thinking to myself, what is this going to end up being? Because I don't think anyone has ever seen John Scott on a breakaway. Goalie's not bailing out. He's trying to stop the puck. He doesn't want to get embarrassed. He doesn't want John Scott to score on him.
And I just made a couple moves and...
And John Scott beats him. Top shelf on a breakaway. And it's bedlam. And it's the big moment where it's like, okay, you know, it was a gimmick, it was a joke. But this guy just did something pretty special in this game.
I had to actually do some skating and some hockey moves, and I beat a world-class goalie. So it was a little bit gratifying to say, you know what, here you go. I got a decent goal, so you can kind of shove it.
The biggest moment was when fans are again voting for the MVP of this whole thing.
This again is Emily Benjamin from NHL.com.
The voting is on Twitter, and all of a sudden, you know, we're all watching our Twitter feed as media members, and Vote Scott just keeps popping up everywhere. And people are retweeting it, and people are tweeting it 12 times in a single tweet.
Democracy in action. Hashtag vote MVP Scott.
Is it too late to start a hashtag vote John Scott for president campaign?
And you sort of feel the groundswell of, this is where everyone wants it to be. The question is the league going to follow through?
The 2016 Honda NHL All-Star MVP scored 2 goals in the tournament and wins as a write-in candidate, John Scott!
What do you want to say first to the fans of Nashville?
Just thank you so much. You guys have just blown me away. I love this city and thank you so much.
Cinderella stories in the NHL are few and far between.
Again, Greg Wyshynski.
And so when you get moments like this, where you have someone you can root for against the odds, and not only do they excel, but you get the fairy tale finish where he's literally raised on the shoulders of his teammates at the end, like Rudy, it really does become one of the most memorable things that I've ever seen as a hockey fan.
So after the game, John goes back to Michigan. The twins are born, and his minor league team tells him, you know what, John? Don't worry about the rest of the season. Stay at home and be with your family.
Oh, sorry. You know, it's harder than hockey, to be honest with you.
Being a dad?
Oh, yeah. 10 times harder. It just never stops. Hockey, there's 60 minutes, the game's over. This is 24-7, as you can hear. What do you need, kiddo? Yeah, see?
Help us rake.
Help you rake? I got a baby in my hand.
When I spoke with John in the summer of 2016, he was still hoping to get another shot at the NHL.
Maybe some team likes me. They want to sign me. I have had a pretty decent year. I've, you know, put up more points than I have prior. So hopefully I can get a shot to play somewhere. I think I can still play.
And though I hate to say it, this was the sad footnote to John's fairy tale story. Ever since the guy stumbled into becoming an enforcer, he kept trying to show people that he was also a really good hockey player. But even when he did that, on the biggest stage in the NHL, his phone never started ringing. In the fall of 2016, at the age of 34, John announced his retirement from pro hockey. Maybe, despite everything he did, he just couldn't shake that goon label.
That story comes to us from Anders Kelto. He's the senior producer of Game Breaker with Keith Olbermann. It's a new audio series available exclusively from Audible. John Scott is the subject of the first episode, but the series will also introduce listeners to an Olympic swimmer who bucked the rules, an ultramarathoner who feels no pain, and much more. We have a link at onlyagame.org.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, the story of a guy living under a bridge who told a newspaper man, "You ought to do a story about me. I played in 3 Super Bowls." But right now, it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill, and hello to our new friends at WNYE in New York. New York, a city so nice they named it twice.
And it never sleeps.
That's right.
On the eve of the NCAA basketball tournaments, it was revealed this week that the NCAA's revenues had topped $1 billion. Good news if you're an NCAA administrator, a university president, or a college basketball coach. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, not something with which players need concern themselves at all.
They can't afford to pay these guys, Bill. They're only making $1 billion.
The University of Connecticut women's team led Cincinnati 43-5 at the half on Monday evening. They ended up winning that game 75-21. Defense fell apart in the second half, I guess. Nobody's surprised at this point by UConn doing that.
I'm not either. I mean, that upset by the University of South Carolina last year looks bigger and bigger.
Yes, indeed.
We had that game. We had the fact that UConn is now 100-0 in their conference play.
Yeah.
As you pointed out, I think, earlier, why doesn't everybody just go to another conference?
Make up a new conference and don't let UConn in
exactly.
Exactly.
And they are still the number one team in the women's basketball poll.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver suggested this week that perhaps the Chicago Bulls were sitting the wrong players on the bench. Why? And what business of the commissioner is it who the Bulls put in the game?
Well, they're very concerned about obvious tanking, which the Bulls essentially committed to when they traded Jimmy Butler before the season started. But the commissioner would like the people paying top dollar to at least see the top players for 5 or 10 minutes.
Throughout the winter, it looked as if the exceptional baseball career of Ichiro Suzuki, who is 44 years old, might be over. But this week he signed a 1-year contract with the Mariners, so he'll be back where he began his major league career back in 2001 after he'd already led the Japanese Professional League in hitting for 7 consecutive years. I think Seattle fans should be pleased.
I think it's terrific. I really do. It gives Seattle a chance to give him a day at the end of the year, which I think is certainly he deserves.
Roger Bannister died this week. He was 88. He's known for running the first sub-4-minute mile back in 1954. It's worth mentioning, certainly, that he went on to have what has been termed a long and distinguished medical career, so not a fellow who rested on his laurels, significant as those laurels were.
Yeah, we don't have these things anymore, but it was one of those things. People actually believed that the human body was incapable of running a mile under 4 minutes,
right,
simply because nobody had done it before. And, I mean, if you read the account of the race, this was a perfectly structured assault on this barrier. He had not one but 2 rabbits running out in front of him. He had planned it out. And then a couple of months later, he and John Landy both ran under 4 minutes.
Right. That's exactly. The Golden Mile, I think they called that. NHL players were recently asked to name the best player in their game, Charlie, and Sidney Crosby won in a walk or a skate. Anyway, he won. Surprised?
No, not at all. But I am surprised that Connor McDavid, the young player for the Edmonton Oilers, came as close as he did. He won two of the categories. He's the fastest skater and the player with whom you'd most want to start a franchise. His problem, basically, is that he plays in Edmonton, which was a problem for Wayne Gretzky. I mean, you might as well play on Mars as play in Edmonton. But Connor McDavid, if he comes to your town, go see him. He's really worth it.
Some evidence this week that football coaches have a sense of humor, or at least some of the coaches who've worked for the Cleveland Browns do. They've formed a kind of club, right?
That's right. The Fired Browns Coaches Club, and they have a party.
It's a big club.
And it is a big club. There are about... what, 3, 6, 9, 11 people in it at this point? You know, that's just the head coaches and the coordinators. I mean, they're going to wind up having to turn people away at the door the next Christmas party.
Last weekend, the Fairless High School baseball team from Massillon, Ohio, held a fundraiser. One of the auction items was a jersey worn by former Indiana basketball coach Bob Knight, and it was stolen. And the school has offered amnesty in exchange for the jersey. So I guess the big question is, will Bob Knight give it back?
Not for $250, which is what its estimated worth was. I love the fact they were holding that fundraiser in a bowling alley, though.
Of course.
Because you have to expect problems if you're going to do that.
And finally, Charlie, we turn to soccer and the unfortunate Sanchez what? Who plays for Hemel Hempstead. His problems on the pitch began when an official attempted to give the lad a yellow card and asked his name. Should we let Bud Costello take it from there?
I was about to say. This actually happened, folks, and it proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that Abbott and Costello were ahead of their time. You know, to book him, he asked the player his name, and the player said, what? And the referee thought he was making fun of
him. Don't be a smart aleck.
And red carded him off the field. You know who was particularly outraged was goalie I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Happily, the ref was informed that he'd made a mistake and the player was allowed to come back. So that was the good news. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
What? David Rubin is a retired English professor. It's perhaps redundant to say he's a storyteller. Recently, he told me about a story he'd written for the celebration of his 80th birthday.
So it was last spring, in the spring of 2017, that I actually wrote the story.
Roughly 70 years after the events depicted in the story.
That's about just right.
Imagine David Rubin at 10. He's living in Cleveland, and his family has just recently been made whole because David had spent several years in an orphanage while his father was in a tuberculosis sanitarium. David says he was a handful in those days, and his mother had no choice but to give him up temporarily. For winter recreation, young David had an enormous field that the city would flood, a place he recreated when he wrote his story.
Every day after school, I would look out from our flat and see whether the ice was fit for skating. When the ice was too soft or watery, the light was red, and I moped around the house, itching to get out there. When the light was blue, I'd sling my skates over my shoulder and head for the flooded field, now solidly frozen. Sometimes the ice was rough and bumpy, sometimes smooth as glass. After a while, I got pretty good. For a kid, I mean.
For that 80th birthday party, David's wife, Eleanor, asked everybody in the family to be prepared to tell a story. David felt the story with his 10-year-old self at the center would work, especially for the grandchildren who were hockey fans. Because in the story, well, David should read from it again.
One day out of nowhere came a tall, swift skater, a full-grown man who whizzed around the ice with a grace and ease I had never seen before. That's High Buller, one of the kids said. He skates for the Cleveland Barons. He's a great defenseman, and he must live around here somewhere.
That a pro hockey player, even a pro playing for a minor league team, should appear on a frozen playground seems unlikely enough. But apparently, for High Buller, skating in the neighborhood felt natural. In hockey circles, he was known as a hard guy, but there was much more to him.
He was a community person. He was a chevra man. A chevra man. He was a man of the community.
He was indeed. In fact, Buller helped to establish and support a Boys and Girls Club in Cleveland. But as a 10-year-old, all David Rubin knew was that he'd skated on the same ice as a pro. He ran home and told his father about High Buller. And shortly thereafter, his father came up with tickets to a Cleveland Barons game. Rubin doesn't recall whether the Barons won that game, but he remembers the fight that interrupted it.
High Buller was taking a terrible beating during this fight. He was cut and he was bleeding. There was, his blood was all over the ice, to my eyes. And I feared for him. I feared literally for his life.
For several days, Buller didn't appear on the frozen field.
You know, I was on the lookout for him, and suddenly there he was, skating again. And for some reason, I was alone, or at least so my memory tells me. I was alone following him.
Following him at some distance. But eventually, Rubin, and remember, he was 10, eventually he found the courage to approach High Buller, whose face was still swollen.
And said to him, I saw the fight, and then I said the kind of stupid thing that people say to athletes and others who get hurt, are you okay?
Buller said he'd soon be back in uniform, and then he didn't just skate away.
He asked me my name. I told him. He then asked me, he said, are you Jewish? And I said, yes. And he said, me too. I'm Jewish too. Just about at that point, handed me his hockey stick and his practice puck. And he said, you take these.
It was a scene Rubin recreated in the story he wrote.
Then he skated off into the dusk, leaving me alone on the ice, gazing up at the blue light above the warming house. In my hands was a Northland hockey stick with High Buller's name on it. In my pocket was his puck.
Writing the story helped Rubin understand why that brief connection with High Buller had meant so much.
I think he sensed something about me. I had always looked for other fathers, with my own father kind of on the sidelines, if we use a sports language a bit. From a very early age, I was wandering around everywhere looking for fathers.
High Buller left Cleveland and played 3 years with the New York Rangers. He made an all-star team. David Rubin, as previously mentioned, went on to a solid career as an English professor slash storyteller. He thinks he knows why the youngest members of his family particularly enjoyed the High Buller story.
Because it conveyed both the hard times of my childhood and also kind of emerging into a better time.
You got that? Aspiring writers, hard times during childhood, sure, but then a kind of emerging into a better time. Write it down. Write it down. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Dave Souza. And our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from David Rubin, who talks about what it's like to listen to Only a Game.
In my mind, it went on forever, but it probably went on for 2 or 3 or 4 minutes.
No, he's just kidding. He told me he really likes the show. I'm Bill Littlefield. I hope you do, too. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.